December 15th, 1995. Bristolville, Ohio. The children of 36-year-old John Markley and his 32-year-old wife Shelley Markley return home from school and discover that their parents are not there. The couple's pickup truck is also missing, and it is soon found abandoned in a nearby town. It turns out that on the morning they disappeared, John and Shelley were seen cashing a check at a bank's drive-through window, and even though the teller recalls seeing another man inside the truck with them, he is never identified, and no trace of the Markleys is ever found. After that, the trail went cold. Hello, everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host, Robin Warder, and today we're going to be exploring a very strange missing persons case involving a married couple, the 1995 disappearances of John and Shelley Markley. On last week's episode, I covered two separate cases where one half of a couple was murdered and the other half went missing, so this week, I thought I would now focus on a mystery where a couple went missing together. I first learned about this case when I came across a post about it on the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit 2 months ago, and it's definitely a weird one. It involves a couple named John and Shelley Markley who lived in a rural home with their 5 children, but when the kids returned home from school one day, they were surprised to discover that their parents had vanished. The couple's pickup truck was also missing, but the condition of the house seemed to indicate that someone had been searching for something there and that John and Shelley were forced to leave in a big hurry. It would turn out that the Markleys had been seen cashing a check at a bank's drive-through teller window, and there was an unidentified man inside their truck who was likely forcing them to withdraw money against their will. The pickup truck was later found abandoned, and even though a potential suspect would pop up on the radar after making an attempt to extort the couple's relatives, opinions seemed to be divided about whether this man was nothing more than a sleazy opportunist or if he was involved in John and Shelley's disappearances. Since there isn't a whole lot of information available about this case, I'm also going to be discussing the unsolved 1974 disappearance of Joanne Coughlin. Even though these cases are not connected, they have a number of things in common. They both took place in northeastern Ohio near the Christmas holidays, and they each contain an incident where someone attempted to withdraw money from the missing victim's bank account at a drive-through teller window. Both these cases are still unsolved, so after I finish discussing the Markleys' disappearance, I'm going to take a few moments to talk about the disappearance of Joanne Coughlin. Anyway, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, including stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now start off by exploring the disappearances of John and Shelley Markley. Our story begins in 1995 in Bristolville, Ohio, an unincorporated community located in Bristol Township in Trumbull County at the intersection of State Routes 45 and 88. Our central figures are 36-year-old John Markley Jr., who works as an independent truck driver, and his 32-year-old wife Shelley Markley, who is a stay-at-home mom. The couple have been married for 16 years and live in a rural home on Greenville Road with their 5 children, 15-year-old Ruthie, 14-year-old Stacy, 13-year-old Bonnie Renee, 12-year-old Crystal, and their only son, 8-year-old Johnny. In fact, the date these disappearances take place just happens to be Johnny's 8th birthday. At around 8:30 a.m. on Friday, December the 15th, all of the Markley children went to school, but when they returned home later that afternoon, they were surprised to discover that the front door was unlocked and their parents were not there. The couple's red and silver 1990 Chevrolet pickup truck was also not at the residence, and even though John and Shelley would usually leave a note for their children if they ever went out, they did not do so here. When the children went upstairs, they noticed that the family's gun cabinet was now open, even though their parents ordinarily kept it locked at all times. A small lockbox safe the couple loaned was lying on the sink in the master bathroom, and birth certificates and other documents which were usually kept inside there were now scattered all over the place. A coffee pot in the kitchen was still cooking and it nearly boiled dry, and John's wristwatch, which he almost never took off, was on a shelf above the stove. Shelley's cigarettes, cigarette holder, and lighters were also lying on the kitchen counter next to a half-empty cup of coffee. In addition to their pickup truck, John also owned a 1978 Corvette, which was still parked inside the garage. However, even though John always kept the vehicle covered with some tarps, they had also gone missing. On the surface, it appeared that something had happened inside the residence, which caused John and Shelley to leave in a big hurry, though there were no apparent signs of struggle to indicate that any intruders had been there. Even though the gun cabinet was open, the children did not know how many firearms their parents owned, so no one could be certain if any guns were missing. But one detail which seemed particularly unusual is that some clothing was lying on top of John and Shelley's bed as they were planning to wear it to awake later that evening. You see, just 2 days earlier, the family had experienced a major tragedy when John's twin sister, Bonnie Markley Donaldson, passed away after a 3-year battle with breast cancer. Even though doctors had told Bonnie there was nothing they could do for her, the family still raised $15,000 in hopes of sending her to Mexico for additional treatment. According to his siblings, John prayed really hard for God to heal Bonnie and was at her bedside when he died, which left him very distraught, angry, and bitter about the situation. Indeed, John had experienced a lot of personal tragedy during the past 2.5 years, as his family's home burned down in a fire in July of 1993, his father, John Markley Sr., passed away 1 year later, and he lost a nephew to suicide just 1 month after that. But according to one of John's sisters, Linda Mason, after she told him that Bonnie had been in a lot of pain and anguish, and God took her so that she wouldn't have to suffer anymore, John seemed to be in a better frame of mind. When their parents did not return home, the Markley children went to the residence of their paternal aunt and uncle, Judy and Thomas Yeager, who wondered if John and Shelley had decided to take off for a while because John needed some time alone to process his grief. They figured the couple would resurface by 5:30 p.m. to attend Bonnie's wake, and also because they had a birthday celebration planned for Johnny. However, John and Shelley did not attend the wake or return home that night, and when they failed to show up for Bonnie's funeral at 2 p.m. the following day, the Yeagers became incredibly concerned and finally contacted the Trumbull County Sheriff's Office in order to report the couple missing. Well, later that same day, the Markley's abandoned pickup truck was found in the parking lot of a hardware store in the town of Warren, located 10 miles south of the Markley residence. Even though the keys were missing, the truck was locked, and a cellular phone the couple owned was inside the cab. In addition, the missing tarps which had been used to cover John's Corvette were inside the truck's bed. Even though there were no mechanical issues with the truck, the exterior was quite dirty, as if someone had driven the truck off-road, which is something that John and Shelley never did. Extensive ground and air searches were performed in the area surrounding the Markley residence, and divers would check a number of bodies of water in the area, but the couple could not be found. In spite of the terrible tragedies that John had recently endured, it did not make much sense for him and Shelley to disappear voluntarily, as they were described as being very loving parents towards their children. Even though their previous house had burned down, the home they were currently living in was paid off, and the couple was not experiencing any apparent financial problems. Even though the children's other relatives would do their best to try and help them experience a happy holiday season, it would still be an incredibly sad and stressful time for them, as Johnny hung a note on the refrigerator which read, quote, "Christmas list, all I want for Christmas is Mom and Dad." Well, there would be a new development to suggest that the Markleys may have become the victims of foul play. At 10:36 a.m. on the morning of December the 15th, 2 hours after the couple were last seen by their children, a personal check for $1,000, which was made out to Cash and signed by Shelley, was cashed at the Cortland Bank in the unincorporated community of North Bloomfield, located 5 miles north of the Markley residence. The transaction had taken place at a drive-through teller window, and the teller who accepted the check was shown photographs of John and Shelley. She recognized John as the driver of the pickup truck who pulled up to her at the window and claimed that she saw Shelley sign the check on the dashboard before handing it to her. But curiously, the teller said that Shelley was sitting in the cab between John and another unidentified man who was seated on the passenger side. The man was described as being slender and dark-haired, but the teller could not recall any distinctive details about this man to provide much of a description. Since the Markley's checkbook was never found, it appeared that this man had forced them to withdraw money against their will. A few weeks earlier, John had received a $1,500 loan to buy new tires for his truck and deposited the money inside his checking account, and after the $1,000 withdrawal, there was still $865 remaining in there. In the weeks following the couple's disappearance, John's sister, Linda Mason, and her husband, Gene, looked after the Markley children at the residence, but they started receiving phone calls from a man who claimed to have information about the couple's disappearance and demanded money for it. Finally, on the afternoon of December the 31st, the man called Linda and instructed her to leave a bag containing $10,000 in cash at a gas station in the town of Niles at 5 p.m. Once he received the money, he promised that John and Shelley would be released. Well, little did the caller know that Linda had already informed the authorities about the phone calls, so they set up a stakeout at the gas station and left a bag there containing rags instead of money. Sure enough, when a man showed up there and picked up the bag, he was quickly arrested and charged with extortion. The man was identified as Stephen Durst, a 45-year-old resident from Warren, and depending on which source you read, he's either been described as a former co-worker of John's or as someone who used to work for John. Whatever the case, Durst was unemployed at the time, and after the Markleys went missing, he had reportedly told a lot of people that they owed him $1,000. Durst would later be convicted of extortion and received a sentence of 4 to 10 years in prison. Now, when Durst was first arrested, investigators told the media that they had no reason to believe that he was involved in the Markleys' disappearance. However, by December of 1996, Jane Timkoe, the chief investigator on the case, publicly stated, quote, "I truly believe that Stephen Durst knows what happened to them, and he just won't say," end quote. Durst initially claimed that he and some others were running a scam to take advantage of the Markley's relatives, and he had no knowledge of John and Shelley's whereabouts. But when Durst took a polygraph, it registered signs of deception to his answers to certain questions, such as when he was asked if he was involved in the Markley's disappearance, or if he had seen them at any point after they were reported missing. Regardless, no conclusive evidence was ever found to point to Durst's involvement. In 1999, after being missing 4 years, John and Shelley were declared legally dead. Following their parents' disappearance, the 5 Markley children went to live with various relatives, but when the oldest daughter, Ruthie, got married and became pregnant, she elected to move back into her parents' residence with her husband. Shortly thereafter, her 2 older sisters, Stacy and Bonnie Renee, decided to move in with them. During a 5-year anniversary article which was published about the case in 2000, Stacy said, quote, "I know I'm still a kid, but I see things differently. We were made to grow up fast," end quote. And Ruthie, who had become the family's unofficial guardian, stated, quote, "I told myself, you've got to turn cold. That's how I deal with it," end quote. Sadly, John's mother, Ruth Markley, passed away in 2011 at the age of 78, without receiving any answers about what happened to her son. In December of 2015, on the 20-year anniversary of the disappearance, the Trumbull County Sheriff's Office announced that they had recently been investigating new information about the case and were conducting new interviews. But unfortunately, it does not sound like there have been any new developments since then, so after 27 years, John and Shelley Markley continue to remain missing persons. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. Thank you. So this is an incredibly sad case on so many different levels, because not only did five children have both of their parents go missing at the same time, but this took place 10 days before Christmas, 2 days after they lost one of their aunts, and on the birthday of the youngest child, Johnny. I just shared a quote from the oldest daughter, Ruthie, who was pretty much put into a position where she had to take on the responsibility of being a caregiver for her younger siblings, and said that the only way to handle the situation was to, quote-unquote, turn cold and put her emotions in check. You may have already picked up on this if you did the math near the beginning of this episode, but Shelley Markley was only 16 years old when she married John, and yes, back in the late 1970s, it was legal for someone that young to get married in Ohio if they had parental consent. Shelley was only 17 when she gave birth to her first child, and already had 4 kids by the time she turned 21. Even though John was described as being a very loving father, he was also very protective of his daughters, and told them that they were not allowed to date until they reached the age of 16. I'm guessing he did not want them to follow the same path that he and Shelley did, and hoped they would wait a while before they started families of their own, but in an ironic turn of events, Ruthie still wound up being put into a position of tremendous responsibility after losing both of her parents. Ruthie and her siblings have had to endure 3 decades of not knowing what happened, so I do hope they've still been able to live happy and productive lives. Before we start going over different theories, I suppose I should probably debunk the idea that this was a voluntary disappearance. The reason John's siblings did not immediately report him missing is because he was very distraught over losing his twin sister Bonnie, so they wondered if he and Shelley just needed some time for themselves for a while. In online discussions about this case, I've seen people put forward the idea that John became so overwhelmed with grief that he decided to orchestrate a murder-suicide, so he and Shelley went off to some remote area to end their own lives, and that's why their bodies have never been found. However, the fact that the couple were seen at the drive-thru teller window with an additional man in their pickup truck should completely discredit this idea, as this clearly indicates that they were the victim of an abduction. Yes, I've seen speculation that the teller might have been mistaken about seeing this man, but it's indisputable that $1,000 in cash was withdrawn from their checking account, and there's no reason for the Markleys to do this if they were planning a suicide. Furthermore, John did not have any life insurance on himself, so he didn't exactly take steps to ensure his children would be taken care of once he was gone. The couple's pickup truck was found abandoned in downtown Warren, which means that if they were suicidal, they would have needed to park there and then walk a great distance into some remote area to kill themselves. The fact that the truck was dirty really does point to a third party driving off-road to dispose of John and Shelley's bodies before they went back into town to abandon the truck, so I think we can safely say that the Markleys were victims of foul play. The last confirmed sighting of John and Shelley is when their kids left for school at 8:30 a.m., but considering that the coffee pot was left on and the clothes they were planning to wear to Bonnie's wake were lying out on their bed, it seems like an intruder entered the house a short time after the children left, particularly since the withdrawal from their bank account took place only 2 hours later at 10:36 a.m. The perpetrator may have been watching the house and lying in wait for the children to leave before they went in, and since the residence was located in a rural area, they would have been able to orchestrate an abduction in broad daylight without attracting attention. We know that a lockbox safe was found open in the master bedroom, and a bunch of documents which were kept inside were scattered around. It's unclear to me if the Markleys kept anything valuable in there that was missing, such as money, but the perpetrator probably assumed that they did. If they were disappointed that the Markleys did not have any valuables inside their house, that might explain why he forced them to drive to the bank to withdraw money. One of the weirdest details of the scene was that the gun cabinet was open, but since the children didn't know how many firearms their parents owned, they could not say if anything was missing. Even though the bank teller did not report seeing a weapon, there's a good chance the man in the pickup truck was covertly holding a gun on the Markleys in order to get them to do what he wanted. However, I'm not sure this gun was taken from the cabinet, because if he didn't show up to the residence with a weapon of his own, how would he have convinced the couple to unlock and open the cabinet in the first place? I think the most logical explanation is that once they found out they were being threatened by an intruder, they may have opened the cabinet in an attempt to grab a gun to defend themselves, but were subdued before they got the chance to do anything. It does not sound like the authorities found any slugs or bullet holes to indicate that a gun was ever fired inside the residence. Another strange detail was the missing tarps, which were ordinarily used to cover John's Corvette in the garage. When I first heard that detail, I assumed the tarps would have been used to cover John and Shelley's bodies, but then I learned they were found inside the abandoned pickup truck, so obviously, the couple was not buried with them. It's never been confirmed if any blood or dirt was found on the tarps, but this could be one of those details that law enforcement has withheld from the public. Back in 1995, DNA profiling was still a relatively new tool in criminal investigations, so I would be curious to know if new testing of the tarps might turn up any DNA. Of course, the big question is what motive anyone would have had to target the Markleys, but all signs point to it being financial. It seems awfully coincidental that this would take place only 2 days after the death of John's twin sister. As you recall, John and the rest of his family had raised $15,000 in hopes of sending Bonnie to Mexico for cancer treatment, but it's unclear to me if this money was ever spent before she passed away. Whatever the case, I'm guessing that a lot of people in the community might have known that this money was being raised, and an opportunist may have decided to capitalize on the whole thing. They may have been under the mistaken impression that the $15,000 was in the lockbox or the Markleys' bank account. Even if the Markleys did not have access to this money at the time, I would be curious to learn more details about their personal finances. It's been reported that they had $1,865 in their checking account before the withdrawal was made, and when you consider that John had recently received a $1,500 loan to buy new tires, that doesn't sound like a lot of money for a family with 5 children, even in rural Ohio in 1995. But of course, that was just the amount in their checking account, so for all we know, the Markleys may have had additional funds in their savings account or from other sources. After all, John owned a 1978 Corvette, and a cell phone, which was a lot more rare and expensive back in 1995, was found in the abandoned pickup truck. So I don't get the impression that the family was that hard up for money. But regardless of their financial situation, why did the perpetrator force the Markleys to only withdraw $1,000 from their checking account and leave an additional $865 in there? I mean, for all we know, perhaps the bank had a daily limit for how much money you could withdraw from a drive-through teller window, particularly if you handed them a check made out to cash. We now live in a world of ATMs, so using a drive-through where you actually had to interact with a bank teller probably seems like a relic of a bygone era. But ATMs do have a limit of how much money you can withdraw at a time, so if the Markleys wanted to clean out their checking account, they may have needed to walk into the bank and personally speak with a manager, which would have been difficult to do with a man holding a gun on them. The perpetrator may have been unable to get his hands on more than $1,000 without exposing himself, and while that does not seem like a lot of money to murder the parents of 5 children, people have been killed for a lot less. So the only potential suspect who has ever popped up on the radar is Stephen Durst, who tried to extort the Markleys' relatives out of $10,000 in the weeks following their disappearance. This is not the first missing persons case I've covered in which someone has attempted to extort money from the victim's family by contacting them with a fake ransom demand. More often than not, when the extortionist was caught, it turned out they had no actual involvement in the victim's disappearance and was nothing more than an opportunist who heard about the case in the media and tried to capitalize on the situation. Regardless of whether Stephen Durst was directly involved in the Markleys' disappearance or just an opportunist, he's definitely a scumbag, and also an idiot as well, if he legitimately thought he could pick up this so-called ransom money at a drop-off point in a public place without being caught. During the initial reporting about this incident, it seemed like the authorities were inclined to believe that Durst was only trying to capitalize on the situation to make some money, but it appears that at least some of the investigators thought that Durst was complicit in the couple's disappearance, or at the very least, had more knowledge about their whereabouts than he was letting on. Indeed, there are a number of details which do point towards Durst being the perpetrator. Sources differ on whether Durst had been a former co-worker of John's, or if he'd actually worked for him, but John's job was described as being an independent truck driver, which suggests that he worked freelance and was not employed by a specific trucking company. So John may have hired Durst to work for him at some point, as Durst was apparently telling people that the Markleys owed him $1,000. I have no idea if Durst's claims are even true, but perhaps in his own twisted mind, if he believed he was entitled to $1,000 from the Markleys, that explains why he only had that specific amount withdrawn from their account while the rest of the money was left behind. Durst was unemployed at the time he was arrested, so he may have been desperate to do something for money, whether it be an extortion scheme or a kidnapping slash murder. On the surface, you'd assume that Durst's involvement would have been a relatively easy question, as the teller from the drive-thru window could just confirm or deny if Durst was the man in the Markleys pickup truck. However, I get the impression that the teller just did not get a good look at this man, as the authorities never released a description of him or a composite sketch. Since the man was described as sitting on the cab's passenger side next to John and Shelley, it's possible they blocked the teller's view of the man's face. If Durst heard about the $15,000 that John had raised for Bonnie, and this was his primary motive for the crime, he was likely very disappointed that he was only able to obtain $1,000. So this might explain why he would take the risk of attempting to extort John's relatives by demanding an additional $10,000 from them. One detail which does point to Durst being the perpetrator is that he lived in Warren, which is where the Markley's abandoned pickup truck was found. The bank withdrawal took place in North Bloomfield, which is 5 miles north from the Markley's residence in Bristolville, and since there's a lot of open and empty space in that area, Durst could have forced the couple to drive anywhere before he murdered them and disposed of their bodies. He then drives their pickup truck south to Warren and abandons it there before he walks back home. However, if Durst was the perpetrator, this does make me wonder what he would have used for transportation to travel to the Markley residence to begin with, as they live 10 miles outside of Warren. Now, when Durst was charged with extortion, he maintained that he had nothing to do with the Markleys' disappearances, but said that he and some others were running a scam in order to get money from the family. But as far as I can tell, I don't believe the authorities found any other individuals who were involved in this so-called scam. However, if Durst was responsible for what happened to the Markleys, it would make sense if he had one or more accomplices. Perhaps someone else drove Durst to the Markley residence in another vehicle and was shadowing them when the pickup truck went to the drive-through teller window. If Durst had an accomplice, perhaps he was the man seen with John and Shelley in the truck's cab, which is why the teller could not positively identify him. Whatever the case, it seems like the investigation came to a standstill when Durst went to prison for extortion, and I have no idea of his current whereabouts. Other than the statement from the Trumbull County Sheriff's Office in 2015, when they said they were investigating new information, it does not sound like there have been any new major developments these past 3 decades. It's possible that investigators believe that Durst was responsible for the Markley's disappearance, but just lacked the evidence to prove it, particularly since the couple's bodies have still not been found. Whatever happened, this is still a very puzzling and tragic case, which has left 5 children with no answers about what happened to their parents for the past 27 years. So if you happen to have any information on the unsolved disappearances of John and Shelley Markley, please contact the Trumbull County Sheriff's Office at 330-675-2508. That's 330-675-2508. So now let's move on to our next case. Our second story begins in Ohio in 1974, and our central figure is 21-year-old Joanne Coughlin, who lives in Youngstown. Joanne is an aspiring actress who often performs at the Youngstown Playhouse, but in order to make ends meet, she currently holds a temp job at the Thoroughfare Distribution Center in nearby Austintown. She hails from a close-knit family and has 3 sisters, and on this particular year, they had a good time celebrating Christmas together, never envisioning that Joanne would go missing within the next 2 days. On Friday, December the 27th, Joanne showed up for work and told some of her fellow employees that she had recently gotten a membership at the European Health Spa in the nearby municipality of Boardman and was planning to go there after her shift ended. When she left work that afternoon, Joanne drove back to Youngstown in her 1968 Ford Fairlane in order to run some errands, which included purchasing a blanket and mailing out a payment for her most recent life insurance premium. Joanne also went to see a female friend, where she outlined her plans to visit the European health spa and then go see her current boyfriend, Dave Pollock. After Joanne and Dave went out to a movie together, Joanne would return to her apartment building to meet her friend, and then they would go to a party. However, Joanne never showed up to meet Dave or her female friend, and no one was able to get a hold of her over the course of the weekend. Joanne's family decided to check out her apartment, and there didn't appear to be anything out of the ordinary, as the only items which appeared to be missing from there were a small suitcase, Joanne's hairdryer, and her bathing suit. But Joanne's Ford Fairlane was not parked there, and seemed to disappear alongside her. On Monday, December the 30th, Joanne did not show up for her next scheduled shift at work and never contacted anyone, so her family became concerned enough to officially report her missing to the Youngstown Police Department. Since Joanne was a legal adult, the police were inclined to believe that she had taken off voluntarily and reluctant to take action. Dave Pollock decided to call up the European Health Spa to check if Joanne ever went there, and the spa confirmed that she did, since her signature was on their sign-in sheet for December the 27th. But Joanne's family was skeptical that the signature actually belonged to her, as they did not believe it matched her handwriting, and no one could actually recall having seen Joanne at the spa that day. While Joanne's mother, Johanna Coughlin, decided to contact the Struthers branch of the Mahoning National Bank, as Joanne had an account there, and had recently deposited $3,400 that she had received as a settlement from a car accident. Johanna wanted to alert the bank about Joanne's disappearance in case someone attempted to withdraw money from her account. Well, believe it or not, in early January of 1975, Johanna received a phone call from the manager of the Boardman branch of the Mahoning National Bank, who informed her of an unexpected development. On December the 31st, 4 days after Joanne went missing, a young woman went to the bank's drive-thru window and handed the teller some signed withdrawal slips from Joanne's bank book. She was hoping to withdraw $800, but since an alert had been set up on Joanne's account, the teller asked the woman to come inside the bank so they could phone Joanne's mother and verify her identity. The woman was reluctant to do this and said something about calling her mother after she arrived in Florida, but the teller would not give her any money. Since Joanne's account had originally been opened at the Struthers branch, the teller told the woman that she would need to contact them in order to resolve the issue, so the woman drove away. When the teller reported the incident to her manager, he just assumed that the whole issue was a personal family matter, which would be resolved at the Struthers branch, so he took no further action. However, 1 week later, the manager read an article about Joanne's disappearance in the newspaper, and it raised enough concern that he decided to phone Johanna. After Johanna confirmed that her daughter had not been seen for nearly 2 weeks, this incident was reported to the Youngstown PD. When Joanne's family checked out the withdrawal slips the woman had given the teller, they claimed that the signature did not match Joanne's handwriting. And when the teller was shown a photograph of Joanne, she confirmed that this was not the woman she had interacted with. Even though Joanne had short hair, this woman was described as having long hair, and the teller said that she was dirty and appeared to be under the influence of drugs. Well, investigators eventually tracked down this mysterious woman, and she claimed that she had been given Joanne's bank book by 2 men, who instructed her to withdraw $800 from the account while they waited at a nearby market. She identified the 2 men as Robert Shugart and Howard Rodriguez, a pair of career criminals who were known for being involved in the local drug scene. In fact, Shugart was suspected of being involved in at least half a dozen unsolved murders which had taken place in the area between 1973 and 1975. Since most of these victims were police informants who were known for sharing information about drug activity, it was speculated that their murders were some form of retribution, though no evidence could be found to implicate Shugart or anyone else. When investigators tracked down Shugart and Rodriguez, they denied having any involvement in Joanne's disappearance or knowing who she was. They did acknowledge having given Joanne's bank book to the woman in order to withdraw money, but Rodriguez claimed that he had stolen the item from a drug party which took place in Warren. But other than Shugart and Rodriguez's own statements, police could find no other eyewitness who could corroborate that this so-called drug party actually took place, let alone that Joanne was in attendance. Investigators did suspect that the 2 men had met Joanne at some point, as they were known acquaintances of her ex-boyfriend. Now, it should be clarified that this was a completely different individual than Joanne's current boyfriend, Dave Pollock, as this other guy had been married during his relationship with Joanne. The ex-boyfriend was a known heroin user, and it was suspected that he had introduced Joanne to the local drug culture. In fact, he once took Joanne to a party, which was held at the apartment of one of the alleged informants that Shughart was suspected of murdering, and the party took place only 18 days before his death. Anyway, Johanna wanted to press attempted fraud charges against the woman who had impersonated her daughter at the drive-thru teller window, but the Youngstown PD asked her not to do so. They believed that the woman could be a potentially important witness for whatever happened to Joanne and wanted to keep an eye on her in case she provided any additional information which could implicate Shughart and Rodriguez. However, nothing ever came of this, and no fraud charges were ever filed against any of these three individuals. But there would be an additional lead in February of 1975 when a local radio host received a call from an individual who was responding to an offer of a $500 reward for information in Joanne's case. It turned out that at around 10 p.m. on the evening of December the 27th, the same date Joanne disappeared, witnesses had reported seeing a screaming woman being dragged out of a car and placed inside a truck or a van. This incident took place on Villa Marie Road, which was located off U.S. Route 224 near the Pennsylvania border. Since there were a number of quarries at this location, and Joanne's Ford Fairlane had still not turned up, this led to speculation that her body and her vehicle may have been dumped there. In fact, the body of one of the informants, the Robert Shughart, was suspected of murdering, would turn up 4 months later, only about a mile and a half from this location. Joanne's family used the money she had received in her settlement to fund some independent searches of these quarries, but they failed to turn up anything, and it was never conclusively established if the screaming woman the witnesses saw was Joanne. The investigation reached a standstill, and Joanne was declared legally dead in 1985. In December of 2019, homicide detectives from the Youngstown Police Department spoke to the media and confirmed that there was still an active investigation into Joanne's disappearance, but there have been no major developments in quite some time, and she has not been seen in 48 years. So I guess you could say, the trail went cold. So unfortunately, there isn't a ton of information out there about this case, so most of the information you will find is from a YouTube clip of a 30-minute news segment which was produced about Joanne's disappearance by the Youngstown-based TV station WYTV in 1979. It features interviews with Joanne's family, friends, and co-workers, as well as some of the original investigators on her case, and you get the impression that Joanne's disappearance might have been the tip of the iceberg in a much bigger story. It seems quite apparent that the Youngstown Police Department botched the original investigation, and you're left wondering if this was the result of indifference or incompetence, or if something much bigger was going on in the local drug scene at that time. Given that this was the 1970s, it somehow wasn't too surprising to learn that the Youngstown PD were initially inclined to believe that Joanne took off on her own accord, as this was law enforcement's traditional response to missing adults back then if there was no direct evidence of foul play. Joanne's car also went missing, and when people disappear alongside their vehicle, I often think that the most logical explanation is that they accidentally drove into a body of water somewhere. However, since another woman attempted to impersonate Joanne and use her bank book to withdraw money from her account after she went missing, I think you can safely rule out the accident theory. I cannot believe that the Youngstown PD did not show more urgency over this incident, but I think there were some jurisdictional issues during the early stages of the investigation. Even though Joanne did live in Youngstown, there was some debate about whether the Youngstown PD should have handled her case, as she supposedly vanished while traveling to the European Health Spa in Boardman, meaning that her disappearance should have been under the jurisdiction of the Boardman Township Police Department. Detectives from both departments were interviewed during the aforementioned WYTV news segment, and you get the impression that the Boardman Township PD took the case a lot more seriously, and things might have turned out differently if they were able to handle the investigation from the start. The segment was put together by an investigative reporter named Andrea Wood, and there's a particularly ridiculous moment where she's interviewing Pete DeLizio, the lead detective from the Youngstown PD, and he's asked about the eyewitness accounts of the woman screaming on Villa Marie Road on the night Joanne went missing. DeLizio says that he interviewed all the local residents in the area, and none of them recalled hearing any screaming that night, but then Wood responds by saying, quote, "What would you say if I told you that I talked to these same people and told me that they did witness a screaming woman? They not only heard, they saw her being dragged from a car," end quote. And then DeLizio starts stammering and changing his story and saying stuff like, "Oh, well, they did report hearing a woman scream, but they couldn't be positive that the woman was Joanne Coughlin." Afterward, interviews from the Boardman Township police detectives are shown, and they confirm having interviewed witnesses who saw and heard a screaming woman being taken from a car and placed inside a truck or a van. So this indicates to me that the Youngstown PD were either terrible at their jobs and did not care about Joanne's disappearance, or they had a vested interest in her case not being solved. Now, in the Markley case, you get the sense that robbery was the primary motive for their disappearances, but I'm not so sure that was the case with Joanne, as the attempt to withdraw money from her bank account did not take place until 4 days after she went missing. I think it's possible that Joanne was murdered for completely different reasons, and the opportunity to get a little money out of it was just a convenient bonus for the responsible parties. Since this attempted withdrawal was made at a bank branch in Boardman, and the European Health Spa was located in Boardman, it's reasonable to assume that Joanne went missing there rather than Youngstown. Even though the signature was on the sign-in sheet at the spa, there was some dispute about whether it actually matched her handwriting, particularly since no witnesses were recalled seeing Joanne there. It is possible that Joanne was abducted from the spa's parking lot after she arrived, but it does seem like an unnecessary and illogical risk for someone else to go inside and forge her signature on her behalf. But wherever this took place, I think it's reasonable to assume that Joanne was abducted inside her own car. If the eyewitnesses from Villa Marie Road are accurate, then the responsible parties transferred Joanne from her own car into another vehicle, and they may have chosen to do so at that location because it was close to the quarries. It's been suspected that the Ford Fairlane was dumped into a quarry, and Joanne's body may have been inside, but investigators have acknowledged that since the quarries are so dark and deep, it would be very difficult to perform a thorough search of them. And since Joanne was supposedly placed inside a truck or van, it's possible that her car was dumped in the quarry, but the perpetrators disposed of her body at a different location. Whatever happened, the manner in which this crime was carried out suggests that multiple people were involved, and we have at least three promising suspects: Robert Shugart, Howard Rodriguez, and the woman who impersonated Joanne at the bank. So it's pretty astonishing to me that at the very least, those three were not charged with attempted fraud for their attempts to get money from Joanne's bank account. I mean, it's not like they even denied doing this, as Rodriguez flat out admitted that he stole Joanne's bank book from a drug party, though no corroborating evidence could be found that this party even took place. It's possible that the woman, whose name was never released publicly, has no direct involvement in Joanne's disappearance, as Shugart and Rodriguez may have asked her to impersonate Joanne because she was a drug addict and desperate enough for money to go along with something like this. The logic provided by Detective DeLizio is that he elected not to charge her with fraud because leaving her out on the streets might have given her more opportunity to turn up further information from Shugart and Rodriguez, and DeLizio acknowledged that this was a gamble which didn't pay off. But I'm just getting vibes that the police wanted these people free because they were more valuable for something else, such as an ongoing drug investigation, and implicating them in Joanne's case would be a major inconvenience. This would hardly be the first case I've seen in which law enforcement looked the other way on a criminal's illegal activities because they were an informant and too valuable an asset to put in jail. I will say that I would really love to learn more information about Robert Shugart, but the only information I could find about him online or in the newspaper archives were sources related to this case. Shugart was suspected of having involvement in at least half a dozen murders which took place in that area of Ohio during the mid-1970s, and since all these victims were suspected of being informants or having knowledge of drug activity, that seems like a pretty big deal. The WYTV news segment was produced in 1979, and Andrea Wood revealed that Shugart and Rodriguez were both in prison at that point for unrelated crimes, though I don't get the impression that it was for murder, and I have no idea if any of those drug informant murders which took place during the mid-1970s were ever solved. What also revealed that even though Shugart and Rodriguez were questioned about the attempted bank fraud, the Youngstown PD never asked them to provide alibis for the night Joanne went missing. It almost seems like the Youngstown authorities had a vested interest in making her case go away, and this may have happened if the Boardman Township PD had not done their own investigation. So the big question is why these dangerous criminals would have wanted to target Joanne. Well, I think the big wild card in this case is Joanne's ex-boyfriend, whose identity has also never been released publicly. We don't know anything about him other than he was married, was into heroin, and introduced Joanne to Youngstown's drug scene. Not only that, but he may have introduced Joanne to Shugart and Rodriguez, and it's been established that the ex-boyfriend was living in the same apartment building as Shugart at the time Joanne went missing. According to her friends and family, Joanne initially got a kick out of venturing into this world because she almost considered it to be some sort of wild adventure, but about 2 months before she vanished, it sounds like Joanne had a moment of clarity and decided she did not want to be part of this life or have anything to do with drugs. Her next boyfriend, Dave Pollock, seemed to be a real straight arrow, and Joanne was deciding to put her experiences with the local drug scene behind her. However, this has still led to speculation that at some point, Joanne saw or heard something she wasn't supposed to, so Shugart, Rodriguez, or others who were involved in the drug scene decided she was a liability and made her disappear. But of course, this only opens up more questions. What could Joanne have seen, heard, or known that would prompt someone to go to the trouble of abducting and murdering her and disposing of both her body and her car? Why would this take place around 2 months after Joanne is believed to have had any interactions with these people? How come Joanne was targeted on December the 27th, 1974, which seemed like an otherwise routine and ordinary day in Joanne's life? If she was abducted in Boardman, how did the perpetrators even know she was going to be there that day? Without further information, we can only speculate about this, but there's one final bizarre postscript to this story. In December of 2020, the Youngstown PD claimed they were contacted by someone who said they had information about Joanne's case, and it somehow led them towards another missing Youngstown resident named Frank Saramiel, a 21-year-old who vanished on the evening of July the 14th, 1969. The story goes that Frank went to the International Tavern to meet a friend that night, but never returned home, and a few days later, his abandoned Pontiac Grand Prix was discovered in the tavern parking lot. The vehicle was unlocked and the doors were open, and since Frank was known to cherish his car, his loved ones did not believe he would have abandoned it like that. For reasons unknown, it seems like Frank's missing persons report was closed at some point, though there's nothing to indicate he was ever found. We also have no idea why a new tip about Joanne's disappearance led investigators to this particular case, given that both victims went missing 5 years apart. But it prompted the police to give Frank's disappearance a second look, so his case has been reopened and entered into the missing persons databases. Investigators have not confirmed if they believe these two cases are connected, but it just adds another strange element to this story. I do think it's very likely that Joanne Coughlin was murdered, possibly by people involved in the drug scene, and even though nearly 50 years have passed, it is good to know that the Youngstown PD cold case detectives are still investigating it, and seem to be taking it more seriously than the original investigators. So if you happen to have any information about Joanne's disappearance, please contact the Youngstown Police Department at 330-742-8900. That's 330-742-8900. But if you just have your own thoughts about what happened, feel free to leave me a comment or send me an email to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. Now the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. This past month, we released a bonus episode about a fraud case from Unsolved Mysteries involving a man named Woody Kelly who embezzled millions of dollars from his clients before he vanished without a trace and has not been seen for nearly 38 years. I've also dropped an exclusive bonus episode from my spinoff podcast, The Path Went Chilly, in which myself and my two co-hosts, Jules and Ashley, discuss another case from Unsolved Mysteries, the 1992 murder of Heather Uffelman by an individual known only as Tom Johnson. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I would also like to give a shout-out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Stephanie R., Lauren R., and Susan G. Thank you all so much for your support. I also just wanted to mention that The Trail Went Cold will be in attendance at two separate CrimeCon events that are taking place in 2023. The first one is CrimeCon UK, which is returning to London and will be held at the Tower Bridge Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa on June the 10th and 11th. And 2 months after that, I'll be attending the regular CrimeCon event, which will be held from September the 22nd to the 24th at the World Center Marriott in Orlando, Florida. Our podcast has a specialized promo code, which can be used to get a special 10% discount on tickets, and this time around, the same code is valid for both events. So in order to purchase tickets and get a 10% discount, you can either visit crimecon.co.uk or crimecon.com and use the special promo code COLD23. That's COLD23. Oh, and I also wanted to announce that The Trail Went Cold is just signed for this year's True Crime Podcast Festival, which is taking place from August the 25th to the 27th at the DoubleTree by Hilton Hotel in Austin, Texas. For more information, please visit their website at truecrimepodcastfestival.com. I just want to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. Anyway, next week will mark a very special occasion for The Trail Went Cold, as our podcast will officially be reaching its 7-year anniversary. And to commemorate the occasion, we are once again tackling a very convoluted story, which means we'll be releasing another multi-part episode. So have yourselves a great week and join us next Wednesday for part one of our special anniversary edition of The Trail Went Cold.